stem cells in terms of kind of looking at drugs or other longevity supplements. Are you working on that? And can you, is there anything you can tell us about what you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do have a couple of thoughts on this issue because I think now we are at this phase of, let's say, mass adoption when it comes to different longevity techniques. And this is great to see because there is more awareness, there is more VC funding floating into this. I literally have VCs contacting me every month asking me if NMN Bio is in need of funds. With that, I expect more public funding to go into developing more robust preclinical data models, because what we're going through right now is that we're very bad at human clinical trials, right? Because 90% of the time, human clinical trials end up in failure of meeting specific endpoints that are being assigned to this human clinical trial for a particular compound, right? And this is not only with regards to neurodegeneration, where, by the way, we had failure after failure for years, right? So all Alzheimer's disease drug candidates failed to meet primary endpoints in human clinical trials until recently. There was one that was approved, but I actually have second thoughts about this one as well, because I don't think that this is like the most optimized Alzheimer's disease drug. And actually, I think that we still have a long way to go to understand how we can produce highly efficient drugs. So there are a couple of things here. So first of all, it has to do with how we think about aging and how we think about what we're studying, right? Because until recently, no one thought that aging is a disease. And this realization is very important, because once we realize that age, like, we can pour more resources and funding into studying aging, and then as a result, we actually will be having much better drug candidates that would be efficient for different endpoints in clinical trials and for different diseases, what we call the diseases of aging, right? So the top four killer diseases right now is neurodegeneration, diabetes, cancer, and cardiovascular disease. And for all of those diseases, the higher risk of developing this disease is actually the age of the patient. So they're all age-related diseases, right? So we need to kind of reframe how we view aging and how important it is to study. And my second point here is that why do human clinical trials fail at all, right? So there must be a reason, because right now we kind of don't understand why, but we start getting a grip on preclinical disease models. And this is when stem cells come in, because if we're generating preclinical data that will be a guide to take a drug candidate through all the way up to a human clinical study, the preclinical data need to be robust. If we're doing this in immortalized cells, cancerous cells that have a physiological properties that actually don't match what's going on in the human body, of course, we're going to have a high rate of failure later on in human clinical studies, right? So far, before the 2000s, before we had all these tools that we now have to develop human embryonic stem cell-derived platforms and induced pluripotent stem cell-derived platforms for drug experimentation, we were using immortalized cell lines, we were using cancerous cell lines to gather some sort of preclinical data and then test this into some animal models. So, for example, mouse models or non-human primate models as well. But interestingly, here, there could be a different kind of discrepancy that will also lead us down to a wrongful way when it comes to human clinical trials, and we will only realize it hundreds of millions later, right? So the problem is very severe, and how we do research needs to be fundamentally changed. So what happens with stem cells now is that we now are developing different protocols to differentiate pluripotent stem cells, and pluripotency means that they basically can be differentiated into virtually any cell type, right? And we can do this both with human embryonic stem cells, as I said, taken from a human embryo, or we can do it from induced pluripotent stem cells, meaning that we just take the patient's skin and then we differentiate it into this pluripotent state. And then from there, we can again model disease with those particular genetic mutations and with those characteristics that the patients have. So now it becomes the preclinical model becomes more precise with this. And not only that, but so far, before again, the recent developments, we only had the capability to have cells on a petri dish in a basically 2D kind of like one layer kind of setup, right? But now, as stem cell biology is being developed, we now have the capabilities to start modeling in 3D, what we call, right? So we can have a floating cell culture with stem cells, right? And from there, so we have a clump of cells basically floating, and we culture them this way in a particular cell culture configuration, where we can basically grow different kind of models in 3D. So we take some stem cell clumps, for example, and then we put the growth factors that they need in order to differentiate into neurons. So now we're having neurons in 3D. So now it's like little brain balls that will be having a much more precise biology and much more precise resemblance of what is going on in our brain, actually. And we can study it, and we can put drugs on it and different compounds, and to see what's going on with their metabolism, right? So this area of stem cell biology is fascinating to me, because there are a lot of discussions about regenerative medicine and stem cell injections and whatnot. But this use of stem cells, this could be life-changing. It can completely transform how we do preclinical research and what kind of data we get out of it in order to take a drug compound and then to proceed with human clinical trials, increasing the chances of us being successful and meeting the primary endpoints in human clinical trials. And this is the preclinical stem cell aspect of it. And of course, there are a couple of other preclinical points here worth to be noted. For example, when we go into mouse models, sometimes if we're studying a different species such as mouse, for example, it's easy to obtain some sort of data, but again, how misleading are there? And if we're looking into neurodegeneration, for example, we do have, the genetics is actually completely different, because the mouse brain, it's actually smooth. It doesn't have all this formation in the cortex that the human brain has, right? So the morphology is completely different. And then no surprise that we're going to generate some data, some preliminary data in mouse models, and then it's not going to work. And unfortunately, some drug candidates are even proceeding into human clinical trials before verifying their data from mouse models to non-human primates. And then again, like the confidence in this drug candidates becomes lower and lower. And unfortunately, then we, like hundreds of millions of dollars later, we have this human clinical studies trial. So a lot of really exciting things going on right now in the preclinical data space with utilizing stem cells and other things in order to get more accurate data. And I think that we also have to think about where do the basic biology insights are coming from? Because they're all coming from academia, right? So the mechanistic links between different molecules and proteins, we're going to get this data from academic institutions that are usually they're underfunded, right? And unfortunately, PhD students is just, underpaid lab technicians that are spending significant amount of their time in the lab, working over hours. No one's paying them for that. And sometimes it's actually more convenient for an institution to hire a couple of PhD students instead of getting more automation for the lab, for example, right? But if you don't have the automation, you're not going to have high quality outputs either. So for example, just to put things into perspective, you know, with stem cells, we have, there are some different stem cell culture robots, what we call, that can basically pipette the stem cells and whatnot. And this is completely different from a robot that can culture normal cells. And by normal, I mean immortalized or cancer cells, because as I said, they're not very fussy. So, you know, they just grow like weed by themselves. But with stem cells, you need to manually, so for example, when you're growing, let's say, a stem cell derived neurons, so they start forming beautiful neuronal networks on the plate. But now, in order to feed them, you actually need to tilt the plate yourself and then pipette it slowly, like almost dropwise. So it's a very laborious job. And there is a high quality, high tech robotic automation for a stem cell facility costs £500,000, right? So the cost is super high. So instead, and for example, in the UK, I think there is only one institution, the Oxford University Institute of Stem Cells, that does have such an automated facility. And all the other universities in the UK that are studying stem cells, they have so much money or labor that needs to be done by either PhD students or lab technicians. And this takes up a significant amount of time and resources from those researchers, instead of, you know, studying another paper or designing more experience and so on. So there are a lot of areas that could be automated in preclinical research, I believe. And I'm a strong advocate for this. And I think that the future is exciting, because we will, like, we are getting more and more awareness when it comes to when it comes to the need of obtaining more accurate data, and hopefully this will manifest into more public funding, because this is where the basic biology insights are coming from.
Right. So these three-dimensional clumps of cells, would that be an organoid? Is that what?
Correct. Those are called organoid. Yeah, they're right. Very exciting. And because they resemble the cell-to-cell interaction more accurately, right? And this is where their advantage is. So, yeah, I think that those are also requiring more expensive reagents and more automation and so forth. Right. So hopefully we'll see more of those in the near future.
Right. And just one last thing. And they spontaneously start interacting, right? So, like, you put a clump of brain cells together and they spontaneously kind of connect all by themselves.
So you put them together at the previous stage. So you put them together at the stem cell stage. Right. And stem cells actually, so they grow in those clumps. Either it's 2D culture or 3D culture, they still need to basically hold hands, right?
Right.
So they have those great little round colonies that they form, and they grow all together. And it looks like there is basically myosine sheaths that we can actually visualize with immunofluorescent microscopy, that is showing that there is a factor that is significant for the colony to maintain their pluripotency. They really enjoy growing together. So they're like a little community of stem cells, and they're holding hands and they're growing all together. And then it's up to the researcher to kind of trick them and feed them with neuronal factors. And then they will think, okay, well, it looks like we need to be neurons now. And then they would form those beautiful neuronal networks.
Right. That's really cool. Yes. Like growing a pet brain. Yeah.